have an artist experience page on Facebook where we put images of things we're talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at us if you can while you're listening.
Good morning, everyone. Wow. This is the only way to describe this past week, as it was Wowdy Week here on the station from October 25th to October 31st. Not only did your community radio station serve up some real specials this week, but we heard from a lot of you, our listeners. We thank you. Many of us contributed and supported the station with gifts, pledges, donations to keep this great community radio station going. Again, we thank you. We cannot do it without your generous support, and we hope you enjoyed the special programming this past week. Sheila and I want to thank the great leaders of this great community radio station at WOWD LP Tacoma Park 94.3 for having the Artist Experience radio program here. And we've been here from the beginning, since the beginning, right, Sheila?
Sure have.
Wow. This is our 83rd show, and we want to thank Marika, Olivia, Steve, and Michael, and so many other volunteers, programmers, DJs, special guests, and of course Bobby Hill, who's with us every other Saturday morning. We thank you all as well. I titled this program Wow, just like the Wowdy Week. Why? Because it's an exhibition currently at the West Wing of the National Gallery of Art called Verrocchio, Sculptor and Painter of the Renaissance Florence. This exhibition goes until January 12, 2020, so you have plenty of time to see this important exhibition, and it's metro accessible, of course, on all basically all the metro lines, and it's free and open to all. Sheila, introduce this wonderful exhibition, but the title is deceiving, as it's just not about Verrocchio, as he was a teacher and some of the other great artists and pupils that he had, like Leonardo da Vinci, Pietro Perugino, Sandro Botticelli, and other works are included by these great artists. It's a wow exhibition.
Yes, it is. So, Andrea da Verrocchio was born in Florence in 1435, and he lived until 1488. So that's not a long time.
Yeah, he was young.
I was surprised. And he was an enormously skilled painter and sculptor. And unfortunately, he's always been largely known for being the teacher of Leonardo da Vinci. It's really interesting how art history got written. Giorgio Vasari, who was an Italian painter, architect, writer, and historian, is most famous today for his writings on the lives of the most excellent painters, sculptors, and architects, which is considered the foundation of art historical writing. He was also the first to use the term Renaissance in print. So Vasari, writing a century later, it seems he was following his own narrative, one that left Verrocchio in the dust as a minor artist. Maybe Vasari just didn't like his style, or he was blinded by his fascination for Da Vinci and Michelangelo, and it became the accepted assessment that Verrocchio was Leonardo's teacher, and that's who he became known as.
Yeah, well, Verrocchio lived at a time in Florence, Italy, where the Renaissance, which means a rebirth, was beginning. This was an explosion of culture, and I say that with a capital C. The arts and scientists were percolating and looking at the worlds of the ancient Greece and Rome for inspiration, and they were beginning to explore worlds beyond their own with new kinds of discovery and invention. The easiest and simplest way to remember the advancements of the Renaissance is to remember our current contemporary fascination with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I share this with my class every time and I get a chuckle. Michelangelo, Raphael, Leonardo, and Donatello. Well, these artists had last names. We're not going to get into them right now. But the simplest way to remember the great artists of the Renaissance is to remember these artists. Well, Verrocchio is not one of them. And he comes really at the beginning, as does Donatello, but he was also a great teacher, and many of his pupils came out of his workshop and atelier to become great themselves. These human beings were not just artists, and I think this is really important for me, Sheila, to share, because they wore a host of hats, like they were mathematicians, philosophers, anatomists, architects. I mean, they just weren't just plain visual artists. And Leonardo da Vinci, for example, was a great musician, one of the greatest in the world at his time. He was an inventor, a naturalist, a cook, not to mention a wonderful draftsperson, an architect and painter. So this exhibition presents a wealth of people's efforts to make the world more beautiful with visual magic and technical virtuosity that defines a process and development of a visual towards a product. This is a must-see exhibition for any artist and any artist appreciator. Sheila, what about the processes here? We have designs, drawings, paintings, sculptures. We talk about artistic process a lot on the show. Why is this significant in this exhibition? Because, boy, it's chock full of process.
Yeah, well, you can see it in Verrocchio's drawings and in his terracotta models before they were cast in bronze. He has a drawing of a horse here, and it's an example of the Renaissance preoccupation with ideal proportions, as in that famous drawing by Da Vinci, the Vitruvian Man. Verrocchio was doing the same with a horse, and what he did was he made a sort of a semi-stylized outline of a horse. And then he further schematicized the body by dividing it up and inscribing it with detailed measurements. So that drawing is in this show. And then he won a competition, which was commissioned by Bartolomeo Conioni to do his monumental portrait. And he created a remarkable horse. It's a bronze statue of that man, Colleoni, on his horse, and the precision of the measurements supports the idea that this study in the show was related to the bronze equestrian statue. This sculpture is almost 13 feet high, not including the pedestal, so you can imagine what it took to create a statue of that weight. And then, of course, he's sort of... this horse is kind of prancing in a light
in
way.
Bronze. Yeah, in it's bronze. Big. It's huge.
Yes. Yeah. It's fabulous, actually. And so Verrocchio brought technical sophistication to bronze casting in an age when few artists knew how to work in that medium and in the scale that was sought after. So at that time, this had not been attempted since the days of ancient Rome. The much sought-after skills had to be invented for a sculpture, and that supported this kind of weight on the spindly ankles and the horses in mid-stride. This masterpiece was originally made with a wooden armature, and it was modeled in rags and gesso. And then Verrocchio died before the sculpture was cast, so it was considered a masterpiece, even though it was speculated that Verrocchio himself would have done more polishing on the statue.
Ah, interesting.
It's interesting. Verrocchio certainly was favored by the Medicis, and he built the tomb monuments for the brothers, the Medici brothers, Piero and Giovanni. And when it was unveiled, it was hailed as a wonder of the world.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Sheila. You know, that drawing of the horse with the measurements, it's engineering, it's architecture, it's sculpture all in one. And I think that is one of the great examples in the show of pure process and how it became and developed into something else. Well, it's early in his artistic life, Verrocchio appeared to have spent nearly all his time working in Florence, which is kind of unusual. He wasn't getting around much. He was probably so busy. It is said that he worked for Pope Sixtus the fourth in Rome, but there's no real evidence of this. So he was kind of hanging around in Florence, and it was a great place to hang out then as it is now. Instead, Verrocchio spent most of his life beautifying that city of Florence. And then finally, a little in Venice. And of course, those were the two great powers around the Renaissance, Venice and Florence. Verrocchio's reputation in goldsmithing as well as sculpture steadily grew after his death, and many well-known artists went on to study his paintings and sculptures. So not only was a teacher, but he left many examples for teaching. And I think that's very, very important in that sense. I mean, his wealth was not just in his art, is what his art taught.
That's true. That's true. So this is a really compact show. And I love that term, compact, because it's not frightening. You know, sometimes when you go into a large show, you think, oh my God, how many rooms are there? And then you go through that and you see that there's four more rooms. This is
not
like that.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, this has got everything in it is wonderful and important. And it really puts Verrocchio in his rightful place as wonderfulness. So, So when I look, I'm thinking about art from the Renaissance. I'm really prepared for a kind of heaviness, like a darkness, Christ, this
sense.
Oh,
really?
I am.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
I don't see
but
it like
it's
that.
Not true in this show at all. And it's his work has a lightness of motion and grace, and it feels very easy and inviting. And his subjects are familiar. They're what you expect. Flying babies, Christ, and a lot of Madonnas, and lots of animals. And Verrocchio had a great skill of bringing his subjects to life. They seem to be always in motion or about to move. Their expressions are thoughtful, and his likenesses are really seen. He had beautiful mouths and expressive eyes. And yeah, his models are good-looking people, but they're also individuals. The bust of Christ that is a copy that was made from Verrocchio's bronze figure of Christ from Verrocchio's workshop was considered to be the most beautiful portrait of Christ ever created. And it's the definition of compassion. And then the terracotta sleeping youth has beautiful, downcast eyes, and his mouth can only be that of a beautiful dreamer. And this beautiful young body is just there to gaze on. I know that I, unlike Vasari, am drawn in by the beauty of his subjects. But why not?
Oh, absolutely. That sleeping youth is just amazing. You can study that, for hours. Just the anatomy, how he depicts anatomy in terracotta is just amazing. Well, this exhibition alludes to something about art and culture that we have very rarely talked about on the program, maybe just a few times, but this is about the talent in a community and that the culture supports the artist and demands the best for the artist. I mean, in Florence at that time, we have a lot of talent. It's knee-high and deep, and there was plenty of patrons in the arts. So the de' Medicis and the other powerful families, and there were many of them, the Catholic Church, the rich mercantile business people and palace and landowners, they wanted to show each other up with great art. I mean, that's how it was in those days, and their demands on the artists created competition. Competition is in a healthy society is a healthful process. Mm-hmm. And the ancient concept of competition is not the same as we see competition today. And now this is a big opinion by me here. Competition truly means to bring the best out of yourself. That's the more ancient definition. And it has nothing to do with the other guy or gal. You can be the best you can be for your own personal development and skill. Today, I think competition is seen as a reflective of some other person, like that you're competing with someone else, a guy or a gal, to beat in every which way. And I think it was a little different in the ancients, and I think a little different in the Renaissance. Well, during the Renaissance, the artists knew that there were other artists out there, but they also know that they lived in a society that could support them. But this doesn't exist today, and it probably never will. Our society here in America does not support the arts in the same way.
No, it doesn't.
It's absolutely not. It's apples and oranges, mm-hmm. comparing them. And the artist in this current society is extremely marginal. And I'm not just talking about the visual artist. I'm talking about the poet, the musician, the writer, the actor, the designer. We're on the fringe. In this society, they were not on the fringe during the Renaissance.
Right.
Artists are not truly engaged in this aspect, all aspects of society today, and were certainly not in the money pipeline. But in the Renaissance, the artists had the ability to be in the money pipeline. And so that's why they could afford the gifts and the talents and the skills for the artists. The culture and the society supported that. There was a lot of money going around, there's no doubt about it. But the exhibition demonstrates the depth and the breadth of this cultural wealth that we do not have today. And that's just an opinion, but I think this show shows how deep the skills and the talents of the artists were, and how they were represented on the walls of the National Gallery, which they do at a very beautiful job.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you just tuned in, Tom and I are discussing this great exhibition that's currently at the National Gallery of Art on the Mall. The exhibition is titled Verrocchio, Sculptor and Painter of Renaissance Florence. It's an important exhibition, and we are very excited to be talking about it. And Tom, what you said is very important, because if you look at Washington, D.C., which is our city, it was meant to be like a European city.
Absolutely correct, yes.
But when you look at the paucity of art, there is some, but when you think about Florence and think about Washington, D.C., and it seems kind of barren with, you know, a sculpture here and there and a circle of a man on a horse, but it doesn't really. Florence is beauty, beauty, beauty.
Well, I think it also is. Florence has basically, almost, 600 years over it, over us in that sense. I mean, time will tell, but yeah, you're right. Florence, yeah. I mean, a doorknob is beautiful
right.
when you walk down the street.
Well, so I need to emphasize, though, that the Renaissance was built on rivalry. And it was rivalry between artists, between patrons, and between cities.
Yep.
So the rivalry was what drove the art of the Renaissance. At its most extreme, rivalry may devolve into hatred and even bloodshed, like the Hatfields and the McCoys. But the great artists sublimated their antagonism into artistic endeavor, which is what we both want to say, which is so different now from where the measure of success is money.
Well, really quickly, I don't know if that, but Masaccio, the first artist, the first true linear perspective drawing, they suspect he was poisoned by a competitor, another artist.
Oh.
I mean, he broke the mold on linear perspective, and he died when he was like 27. I mean, he had done a few masterpieces right off the top in Florence, and then they suspect the competition killed him.
That I
literally
didn't know.
Poisoned.
Wow. Well, the most famous rivalry was a competition in 1400 in Florence, 30 years before Verrocchio's career, between Filippo Brunelleschi and Lorenzo Ghiberti for the second set of the bronze doors on the Baptistery, which is across from the Duomo.
My favorite monument in Florence.
No kidding. So there were contestants from many parts of Italy, and in the end, they were required to submit bronze panels on the subject of the sacrifice of Isaac to a jury of 34 people. And these people came from many places, but in the end, Brunelleschi and Ghiberti were acknowledged as the leading contestants. And they were both very young, and they were very connected to society in Florence. Brunelleschi was a genius, and he was well-positioned in Florentine society. Ghiberti was a goldsmith, and he was from questionable origin. They had a year to enter their trial panels. The rivalry was encouraged, and it led to a lifelong bitterness between these two. When they entered their competition panels, the judges could see that Ghiberti's panel was even greater than Brunelleschi's, and it also was much lighter, which meant that there was going to be a savings in gold. So the commission went to Ghiberti. The contest between the prototype for later competitions became the prototype for competitions among artists, and it's speculated that Verrocchio worked in Ghiberti's studio.
Yeah, because he was a goldsmith as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes. So Michelangelo was at that time and became the measure of classical conceptions of beauty. Leonardo, Raphael, and Titian were Michelangelo's rivals. Their ambition was to transcend antiquity, and Verrocchio was the oldest. He also won major competitions, but the achievements of the art and the techniques that were produced in Verrocchio's studio were largely credited to the artists that learned those skills.
Well, I think, you know, Sheila, talking about Brunelleschi and Ghiberti and Verrocchio, you're talking about, like, it's like, you know, the, how do you put this? It's like the top tier,
right,
of art, you know, and artists, ever, not to mention Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael. And yeah, these guys were going at it in the city for every possible opportunity. And when they did it really, really well. And so this is kind of what I think this exhibition shows. It actually imposes passion on the viewer, a passion for any subject, mm-hmm, any medium. You know, Verrocchio and his circle, they exude the passion to their craft, whether they're working in terracotta, whether they're working in tempera, whether they're working in pen and ink. Whatever their hands they touched, they did it the best. And this, I think this exhibition really shows that really easily. If you've never been to Florence in Italy, or Firenze, as the Italians call it, art is everywhere. It's like a visual mecca of art. And I mentioned before, a doorknob, a cobbler's shop, down a street, in a church, a bakery, a restaurant. It's everywhere. Art is everywhere on the street, even now in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. So it's part of a sensual experience. And that's a word where I like to throw around a lot. I'm not so sure a lot of people like that word, but it's a sensual experience. All your senses are being attacked. It's overwhelming, mm-hmm, but yet very human. Can we be passionate and human alone, or do we need some divine mystery to keep the passion going? Well, in the Renaissance, which it was Catholic Italy at the time, there was a lot of divine mystery and humanity going on at the same time, and it was all 100% passion. The first room introduces to the great sculpture and theme of David and Goliath, a theme so important to the Renaissance artists like Donatello, like Michelangelo, and here in Verrocchio. Wow, what an entree to the exhibition. Youth with beauty, strength, and resolve slays the devilish Goliath. The biblical Jewish underdog that David was is solid in his faith, his stance, his gaze, his vigilance, and his strength. Walk around this masterpiece and see how every aspect of this work screams in technical prowess and virtuosity in design, drawing, and sculpture. Three-dimensional form comes to life, and this work should convince you with awe that passion works.
Yeah. Well, the Medicis had commissioned Donatello to sculpt a portrait of David, the young shepherd who had slain the giant Goliath. And that became a symbol of virtue and strength and good government for all of Florence. So 20 years later, Verrocchio was commissioned to create another David, which you can see in the show at the National Gallery. His David, to me, okay, this is me, it looks like a kind of skinny, prancing adolescent boy with fine, almost feminine features.
Yeah, but he could sling that sling.
Yeah, it's true. And the head of the slain giant Goliath is at his feet, and that's modeled with so much feeling. The giant, and he's peaceful, and he's at rest in death, while the David has a smirk. He's standing with his little sword and his little tunic. The head of Goliath has been moved many times. When they show that sculpture, it's been to the left, to the right, and between David's legs. To me, there's a particular resemblance to both Donatello and Verrocchio's David to Cézanne's boy with a red waistcoat, which is on view in the National Gallery, right down the hall.
Fantastic
painting.
Yeah,
if you check that out, that's one of the true masterpieces in the National Gallery. But there's a similar stance, and the graceful 15-year-old boy is standing at an angle with his hand on his hip, which is thrust forward. He has a hat on like the Donatello David. The boy in the red waistcoat reflects Cézanne's admiration and connection to the past. He had said himself that he, and I'm going to quote, he wanted to make of impressionism something solid and durable, like the art of the museums. He spent many hours teaching himself to be a painter by studying old masters in the Louvre. This boy's pose, with his hand resting on his hip and the air of languid elegance in his slender form, is almost reminiscent of the 16th century portraits by Mannerist artists. But Cézanne's model was an Italian boy, Michelangelo da Rosa, unusual because Cézanne almost always used family and neighbors as models, so I can't find any proof that either Donatello's David of Verrocchio or Verrocchio's David was ever at the Louvre. I doubt it.
It's interesting mystery.
And Cézanne didn't travel to Italy, but the resemblance in image and feeling is absolutely there.
Well, good for you, Sheila, doing some detective
work. I thought this was really cool. Look at all three. It's really cool. Verrocchio's David is considered to be a very handsome young man, and this has led to speculation by David Allen Brown, who is the curator of Italian paintings at the National Gallery of Art, that the model for the statue may have been Verrocchio's best-known pupil, the teenage Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo's beauty, Brown writes in the catalog, seem no less striking to his contemporaries than his talents. Apprentices also often served as models in those days. And Brown notes that the statue's features are very similar to those of a drawing of an older Leonardo. So if you'd like to see our Leonardo's face, check it out.
Well, yeah, I would definitely check it out. Well, you know, Leonardo was known to be extremely handsome in his youth, and there are stories of him walking down the street, and just he would dress very elegantly. And you mentioned something about the feminine quality to his gaze and his features. Well, people would stop dead in their tracks when he walked down the streets. He was always dressed elegantly. He liked the attention, and he was known to be quite handsome. Well, if you just joined us at the Artist Experience radio show this morning at WOWDLP Tacoma Park, Sheila and I are talking with great passion about a show we titled Wow. And what does that mean? It means WOWDLP Tacoma Park. It's a great community radio station. And we're trying to tie it in with the great Renaissance and the art of Andrea Verrocchio, an exhibition which is currently at the West Wing of the National Gallery. Well, appropriately placed in the exhibition is a work by Verrocchio as you walk in and you see the David and Goliath, but there's also an amazing lateral view bas-relief sculpture of Alexander the Great. And to me, this was really appropriate for the show because many of the Renaissance artists looked to the ancient Greek world for artistic inspiration, especially in sculpture. And Michelangelo, of course, is the great example of looking at Greek sculpture. But they were looking at the Hellenistic period of Greek art, which is when Alexander the Great lived in his very short life. Well, this work in marble is like three sculptures in one. We have, it's in a framed, beautiful gilded frame with a black niche. And you have this wild hat with a dragon on it. That's one sculpture. And the face of the useful and beautiful Alexander from the side. That's another sculpture. And then you have the shoulder and chest plate, which all these mythological faces and features. It's a kind of a virtuosity of design and chisel. And I think, you know, there's not a whole lot of marble sculptures, but that one really kind of is very different and very beautiful. And it's a hats off to Greek sculpture that Verrocchio, like many of the other Renaissance artists, were looking at. And that first room is a knockout room.
Yeah, it is. And it's also spacious.
Yes.
It's not too tight. You're right about that. Yeah. So you can walk around the sculptures. It's really wonderful. And there's a large painting on a panel of Tobias setting out on his journey with the Archangel Raphael.
Oh, that's a knockout.
Oh, it's so beautiful. And Tobias is carrying the fish, which he had to heal his father's blindness. And it was probably painted as a private devotional picture. It's an early work which had formerly been attributed to other artists. This happened a lot with Verrocchio, and they're not sure who did what. But there's a leading expert on Verrocchio thinks that it was probably painted with assistance from Domenico Ghirlandaio. So it's such a colorful, finely painted work, and the way that Tobias and the angel Raphael are communicating with their faces, with their eyes, and the angel guiding lightly with her hand, and Tobias is linking lightly his hand in assent. Just those two hands tell the whole story. And painting hands is difficult. It seems that many contemporary artists just blow off the hands.
For sure.
Yeah, they do. But these hands in the Renaissance, they show us how they can carry the whole expression of the narrative.
Beautifully, beautifully said, Sheila. Absolutely.
Thank you. The different fabrics, the drapery and the embroidery, some magic with paint that is continued through centuries of art, and it's never not miraculous. Look at Ang. And because of other great protégés that worked in Verrocchio's workshop, it's been difficult for art historians to attribute which parts of the paintings were painted by whom. Vasari tells the story about the painting The Baptism of Christ, which is not in the show here. It's in this work, Verrocchio was assisted by Leonardo da Vinci, then a youth and a member of his workshop, who painted the angel on the left in that work and part of the background. And also, according to Vasari, Verrocchio had already done the main work. Leonardo painted an angel that was holding some garments, and despite his youth, he executed in such a manner that his angel was far better than the figures painted by Verrocchio. Now, this is a story done by Vasari, so we take this with a grain of salt. But this is the reason why Andrea would never touch colors again. That's what Vasari said, as he was so ashamed that a boy understood their use better than he did. So later critics consider this story a fiction, and I do too. I mean, come on.
Leonardo da Vinci was young and really good, but I mean, I don't know if he wanted to, show off Andrea so much that he didn't want to pick up color again. Well, we're going to take a station break. Go to our website and see how you can constructively contribute to the great community radio station. Go to TacomaRadio.org and see the fabulous program schedule and diverse kinds of programming we provide. And your contributions are always welcome, and we thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Artist Experience radio program at WOWDLP Tacoma Park, 94.3 FM. We're talking about the art of Andrea del Verrocchio and his students and competitors in the Florentine Renaissance. It's a great exhibition currently at the National Gallery of Art on the Mall in Washington, D.C. And also we are playing music of the Renaissance from that time. Of course, they didn't have recordings. So the music that we've been playing is from contemporary contemporary groups.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad you chose the last one. The last one, I think, was actually a French Renaissance work. Mm. And just for our listeners, the word Renaissance is actually a French word, which is kind of embarrassing since the Renaissance started in Italy, but we use the French word and Renaissance, and it's a beautiful word. And the Italians wish they used their word. But anyway, there are many works in this the first room of the exhibition that are made of terracotta. Terracotta means baked earth. And it's a sculptural and ceramic technique that's very, very ancient. Many cultures use terracotta. It's an unglazed ceramic work that is made of coarse and porous clay, and there was plenty of that in Italy. The clay gives the artist great plasticity, malleability, and versatility in that clay. The materials are cheap, they're readily available, and they're very durable. Well, terracotta was used for statuary, decorative embellishments, and maquettes, and studies for larger works. There's a plaque in the exhibition that was made out of terracotta that you put on a door or something like that on the side of a wall outside. During the Renaissance, it was revived as a higher art form, and the exhibition has many superb examples of the terracotta technique, and some of them are in cases. Well, as Sheila mentioned, there's the polychrome terracotta sculpture of the bust of Christ from 1476 to 1483. Well, this is a very strong head, and it's a very strong bust, and there are many versions of it, as Sheila mentioned. But I think the important thing about this is that Christ's gaze is downcast, and it's thoughtful. He's kind of looking down at us, and it's very loving, and it has an air of humility. And this is very important for the Renaissance artist to capture this. Remember, humanism and the philosophy of the humanistic way. Christ is human, and he's kind of looking at us in a loving way. And right next to it is that powerful sleeping youth that, again, Sheila mentioned. And it's terracotta as well. And talk about anatomical details. And I think this is where I like to mention, these artists are also anatomists. They're looking at the biology of the human figure. And the youth is downcast, and it's a very, very beautiful face. You know, Sheila, looking at that sculpture, I think I can teach a whole semester of drawing and sculpture just in this one work. I mean, that's how much the musculature, the bony structure, the foreshortening of the poses, the hands and the feet are very difficult to do in that pose. And it's very earthy. And I think that's the wonderful thing. And you know, whether it's the beauty of a man that's mythical or biological, the works in this exhibition of the human figure are very real and extremely beautiful.
Yeah, it's also so inviting.
Yes,
it's really like, wow, how can you go that close to a body of great beauty and just gaze on it? It's really beautiful.
Yep.
And I have to confess something. One thing that's happened to me while we've been doing this show is that before we were doing this, I've never been that much interested in sculpture. Huh. I always loved the illusion of paint. That's been the thing that I gravitated toward. And I always think of the sculptures that they're in the way of the paintings. You know, like, get out of the way so I can look at the paintings. Except I have to say, I have changed so much. And I mean, I saw the Pietà in Florence, it was in Florence at the time that I was there, and that knocked my socks off.
Yes,
that is the most wonderful sculpture.
By Michelangelo.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. But now I've become a lover of sculpture. And in the case of the show, even though the paintings are colorful and clear and they're beautifully painted, it's the sculptures that really got my attention.
You know, I was looking at the people in the exhibition, and yeah, it seemed to me that the sculptures were more interested in. Maybe because you could walk around them and things like that. It's very interesting.
I think that's true.
Well, there are many incredible works of children in the exhibition, and we have mythological inspirations from Greece and Rome, Eros or Cupid, the god of love. The Italians called them putti, and they were known as that in the Renaissance. We have a lot of religious subject of the baby Jesus and the baby John the Baptist, and many examples, of course, of the Madonna with the Christ child. So this was very popular. Of course, it's Catholic, the Catholic Renaissance, and so we get a lot of that. But these babies, I mean, they're pudgy, they're full-cheeked, they're bellied, big-bellied infants throughout the exhibition. They're fleshy with folds of fat that babies need. They're absolutely adorable. You know, Sheila, I think I could have modeled for one of those when I was a baby. I think, you know, as the Italians call them, bambini, the little babies in Italian, and or bambino for one baby. And there were plenty of beautiful little babies in that show. And I think it's a testament, again, to looking closely at something like an infant.
Yes.
You know, their anatomy is very, very different than adult, and you could see them in the two sculptures that were in one of the main halls there. I just wanted to go up and hug them. They were just so warm and cute, whether they were cold terracotta or bronze. They were just very lovable.
Yeah, Tom, I had to hold you back from putting your little mouth on their thighs and blowing.
Like, oh, my God, too much information, Sheila.
Well, there is a style that Verrocchio does that I find terrifically appealing. He pays a lot of attention to lips and a tiny upturn at the edges of the mouth, which Tom calls a Cupid's bow. And there's a sense of volume and lightness at the same time. So those babies' wings can really fly.
Well, those lips on the babies, I mean, babies' lips are absolutely beautiful. And the Cupid's bow is kind of, from one side, it goes up and down like a little bow and arrow, and they were looking really closely at these babies' bodies and these babies' cheeks and their lips and their eyes, the whole bit. Well, we mentioned at the outset of these programs that this whole show is about process. Well, there are many designs and drawings and paintings and sculpture all related to this process. And in Italian, the word for drawing is the same as design, and disegnare. And it's very important that we share that if you have to put it on paper to visualize it or create it. And in Italy, that's where the Renaissance, they did it really well. The idea of something on paper is not really helpful. It's kind of useless. It's when you get it on paper that it really counts. And that's where the Renaissance shine. They really could get it on paper well. Well, the exhibition makes clear the connections to all these processes. And there's one room dedicated to totally drawing, except there's a sculpture in that one room, and it's a candelabrum, or basically a candelabra. Well, everybody was probably walking around it. It looked like a light pole. Well, it was so beautiful, and you know, the drawing for it was very necessary. And I think it's really important that the design of that candelabra is much like the design of any drawing and painting. And the work was dated May 1468, and that was to be put into one of the government buildings in Florence, because it was when Venice and Florence, the fierce rivalry during the Renaissance, signed a peace treaty. How about that? The artist made a candelabra for the signing of a peace treaty. I think that's pretty cool that the artist took the effort to do that so it could all the government could see. I think it's a testament to the Renaissance.
It is. That's beautiful for you to point out. Thank you. Well, The drawings are pieces of paper that have survived 600 years. And so each one is important from a scholarly point of view, like this schematic of the horse. There are a couple of drawings that are static figures, and then there are some grotesque caricatures, like those three drunk nude old guys.
I like that one.
That's good. They're said to be precursors of ideas explored by Da Vinci. Now, this is Verrocchio, and once again, Da Vinci is getting the credit, and it's true that Da Vinci did a whole lot of drawings on grotesques, but this is where it started. And some of the drawings are finished works, and some are sketches, and they're always interesting because they're insight into the mind, the thinking of the artist. There's a beautiful drawing, it's small, of an angel, and that drawing is pierced with dots to transfer to a painting. And the what they did was they put dots on the lines, or the artist did, and then brushed powdered charcoal through the holes so that it was transferred. And that is still used today.
Absolutely. I do that in my paintings. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a portrait of a woman with braided hair that's done with charcoal and grease to make the charcoal very black. And that's the first time that's done.
That's
seen
a very
to be
powerful
done.
Image there.
Yeah.
Well, there's a drawing attributed to Leonardo da Vinci, and it's a baby portrait, a study of a child's head from 1477. Wow. That was another wow moment there. This simple drawing in black chalk is about intuitive and economical drawing. Leonardo portrays the baby's face in so few lines, and yet the essence of the face and the energy of the line and the emotion of the subject convey beauty in its simplest way. This is remarkable. And this is what happens when someone knows how to draw well. The room is full of drawings in the exhibition, which is another semester's class's worth of drawing lessons right there in that one room. I forgot to mention, well, we've mentioned it before, that Verrocchio was a goldsmith. And there's a couple of gold pieces in the show that are really fascinating. There's this gilded dove, which I think is amazing, which is probably a decoration for the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit of the Christian Trinity. And it's absolutely amazing. It's just, you know, in other words, it goes into another realm. And that's what these Renaissance artists are doing. They're really stretching their artistic tentacles out as far as they can get them.
Yeah, and I hope we make it clear in this show that for us as viewers now in the 21st century, we're looking backwards. We're looking backwards to ancient Roman Greece, and we're also looking forward to what is going to come. And so it's very exciting for me to make these connections and then look to the future. So Verrocchio, he may have served in the workshop of Lorenzo Ghiberti, who was a master carver, and he was also the greatest goldsmith in Florence by any standard of judgment. And it was in this time, the flowering of the Renaissance, where Donatello was able to move into greater naturalism, and Verrocchio moved from that naturalism into movement. And he was the one that really absorbed the lessons of perspective in engineering, and he developed a newer and more dynamic art.
Well, you used the word lesson, Sheila, and I thank you, because between you and I, we have about 75 years of teaching experience as college and university educators in studio art and art history. So Verrocchio is giving us lessons, and he shared that with his dedicated pupils who went on to greater heights in some ways than the teacher himself. This is what happens with great teachers. Great teachers let their students do their own thing and forge their own path and power with their art. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And when I was researching this show, I found something that really delighted me, and that it's one of the world's leading experts scholars on Verrocchio is Dr. Dario Covi, and he is the man that gave me my first teaching job.
Bravo.
This is really true. He was a quiet art historian, and he was the chairman of the art department at Duke when I was there, and he spent all his time doing research in dark places. You don't know, you can just see this gentle man, and his wife was a poet, is a poet. And they live in Louisville now, and he is now the acclaimed expert. At that time, he was a fish out of water at Duke. There wasn't much attention being paid to true scholarship, and I was too limited in my own thinking to ask him what he was doing. Hmm. But he was kind to me, and he gave me my job when I had no credentials. It was a gift, and I hope he's been fulfilled by this beautiful show at the National Gallery.
Well, Sheila, that's an incredible experience, and thanks for sharing that. Another lesson that great teachers fuel great artists. Good for you, Sheila. Well, we're kind of finishing up the show, but I wanted to talk about one painting, the Madonna and Child with Two Angels from 1470 to 1474. And this is a tempera panel. Now, tempera is very hard to work with. It's ground pigment, basically, in water. And Verrocchio had the help of Leonardo da Vinci and Pietro Perugino. Oh, my goodness, what a way to go. A team of triumvirate kind of artists working on one panel. Well, the refinement, and we haven't used the word refinement yet, is amazing. It's outstanding in this painting. The garments, the faces of the angels. There's the right side of the panel is a very sweet painting of an angel. This will be indelibly, you know, plastered on my mind forever. What a face. It's an absolute beautiful face, and what virtuosity it's painted. And it, to me, it's the clear hand of Leonardo da Vinci's brushwork, the sensibility of the hair. And Leonardo really could do hair. And you couldn't even see a brush stroke in his work. It was so put on layers so softly. And, of course, we also have Perugino working there. The colors and the sensitivity, again, evoke passion, sensuality, and beauty. I hope I'm not being too repetitive here, but bravo to all those painters because they made a masterpiece that's currently at the National Gallery. There are many hidden gems in the exhibition, an array of visual art genres that will mesmerize and inspire you.
Artist Experience would like to thank all our listeners for their generous support for Wowdy Week and their contributions to great community radio, which we are a part of here at WOWD-LP Tacoma Park.
Wow. Well, that's how we name the show, and that's how we name Wowdy, the radio station here. And this is a really very important exhibition, the first of its kind in America, exposing Verrocchio and his circle. If you appreciate art, this exhibition involves the sensuality that humans are capable of bringing to life in a variety of media, design, drawings, and paintings. This exhibition is a treat for you and your family, and it goes till January 12, 2020. Lastly, we also want to thank our supporters and listeners again here for helping us during our fun drive, and we thank you, and we hope you enjoyed the show. Sheila, tell us real quickly about that upcoming show that you're so excited about.
Sure. Well, it's at the Phillips Collection in Washington, and it's Bonnard to Vuillard at the Phillips, and it's a collection of work by the Sants, and it's a very interesting show, and it's not what I thought about when I thought about, Vuillard and Bonnard. It's much more intimate, small works, and we're going to do a lot of work on this show.
Oh, I'm very excited because you're excited, Sheila. Okay, well, stay tuned to great program coming up this Saturday. We have next up Bobby Hill with This Music. Bobby shares his incredible knowledge and musical depth. He does it every Saturday from 10 to 1 p.m. There's Avant-Garde right here, so keep the dial fixed. Experience art and the visual in everything you do. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you.